Welcome back to Vulcan Hello, the Incomparables only podcast dedicated to new Star Trek. I am Scott McNulty. I am joined, as per usual, by Mr. Jason Snow. Hello, Jason.
Oh, I am Jason Snow.
I'm in a strange mood. I guess that's normal. I'm in a normal mood.
You're in a mood. A Scott mood.
I think I'm just giddy because I only watched one episode of Star Trek for this podcast, which I know is weird to say because I love Star Trek and I enjoyed all the new Star Trek. But watching two episodes and then talking about them immediately afterwards is a lot.
It's a little overwhelming. So, yes, we're back to one episode, folks. One episode. And, Scott, that episode is?
Star Trek Picard Season 2, Episode 4, Watcher. And
the
Watcher is not who Jason thought the Watcher was.
The Watcher is not. Oh, there's so much in here, Scott.
Ooh, this is one of those episodes that doesn't answer. It raises more questions than it answers.
Yeah, that's right. There's lots of intriguing details.
Yes,
there's lots of Easter eggs and fan service. Yes. And then also there's lots of car chase.
There is a lot of car chase. I think. Somebody just likes car chases. Car chases are fun. You put these characters in 2024, get them in a car chase. Let them steal a car, chase that car.
So I'm going to come out and say it. I think this is the weakest episode of the season. I thought it was fine. Mm-hmm. I think the other three episodes have been great. I thought this episode was just a little slower. It felt a little like, I know I talk about, especially about Discovery, about the outline of the season and how sometimes there's less in a beat than they think there is. And I felt like this episode was like that, where they're like, oh, well, all this stuff happens in this episode. And when it came to it, it was sort of like, can we extend the car chase a little bit further?
We don't have as much stuff.
Is it maybe, I mean, I'm sure the producers would tell you it was a winking recognition of the fact that so many LA-based TV series devolve into a car chase after a while, but it was not, you know.
You reject that wink.
I guess what I'd say is I enjoyed it because I've enjoyed this whole season and I enjoyed this too. I would say, though, that it felt a little more scant, a little lighter weight. It felt like it was sort of bridging, like somebody I think we were talking to earlier on Slack said something like it felt like the first part of an episode that would then have more things happening, but it sounds like they really wanted the revelation at the end of this episode to be the end of it, and then so it just was a little more lightweight. I think a little less happened. It felt a little more fillery, but fine, because this has been a good season. It just, this episode seemed to not be a home run like the last few. I think were more like a solid single, the opposite way. That's some baseball lingo. Happy spring training to everyone.
You lost me.
So, yeah, I know.
They
hit a touchdown, Scott.
Woohoo, goal. My wife turned to me after we watched it and said, that was unsatisfying.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like they end with a couple of revelations, which I think are interesting, and we'll get to them. But I feel like it just felt unfinished, which of course it is because it's not finished. But it didn't feel, like you just said, it didn't feel like a standalone. It's not a standalone, but it didn't feel satisfying.
Not to use a sports metaphor, so I'll simplify it, but like there's this concept of advancing the ball, which I think comes from football, but it's the idea that like, or if you think about a board game, like episode one, there was like a leap forward. We pushed that piece forward. In episode two, we pushed it forward some more. Episode three, we pushed it forward some more. Episode four pushes it very slightly forward. And when you're accustomed to that level of movement in the first three episodes, episode four was sort of like, all right. Like, I mean, stuff happens in it, but did a whole episode worth of stuff happen in this episode? I think not. I don't think it's bad. I think it continues all the good stuff that had been in the previous episodes, but it feels a little bit like they're treading water. And so if I'm going to grade it on that scale, I'll say I was a little disappointed in it. Again, I'm enjoying the season. It's all fine. But this episode in particular just felt a little bit light, like pacing wise. It felt like they did not have enough to do. And so there was some more kind of filler. And I kept like expecting there to be like, they're like, they get to the place where Rios's bus is going to go by. I'm like, that's it? You just get to where the bus is? Because we got a whole thing with the bus next week. It's like, okay, but we
That was the most glaring thing to me, because I felt like if they had just gotten Rios off that bus, or gotten themselves on the bus, or stopped the bus, or did something, I would have felt like, okay, well, there's kind of a satisfying thing of this episode, but they didn't do anything with the bus except look down the road to see if the bus is coming.
That's right, which is the experience of every commuter. So
it's true.
It's not that exciting. I did that for 15 years of, is the bus? Nope.
Nope, not the bus.
Now?
Oh, nope. Is that my bus? Is that, no, wrong bus.
Nope, wrong bus. Yeah. No. Oh, no, here it is. This is my bus.
I could take that bus, but then I'd have to walk three blocks.
Yeah, no. I'm going to wait for the 18. Mm-hmm. There was just a lot of that. Now, not to say that there wasn't interesting stuff. Like I mentioned the fan service.
Oh, yes. Punk. Speaking of buses.
Speaking of buses, Punk on Bus, everybody's favorite character from Star Trek IV, and I'm serious about that. Kirk Thatcher, a Hollywood lifer who is a director and puppeteer and has been involved with the Muppets and a whole bunch of other stuff. He has this whole rich career, which I always thought was hilarious because he was Punk on Bus in Star Trek IV. Mm-hmm. And here in this alternate universe, and you're saying to yourself, but wait a second, the divergence hasn't happened yet. We'll get to that because it's already a parallel universe. He is on another bus in Los Angeles listening to I Still Hate You. And then he says, I just like the song. And he turns it off. And I thought that was a very broad, ridiculous scene. And I loved it.
Yes, it was. It was
just fan service.
And I felt.
Thank you for the service. Mm-hmm. Signed, a fan.
It was fantastic. And Marisa said, oh, that's funny that they're referencing that thing. And I said, they're not just referencing it. That is the same actor who did
that's
it.
That's the guy, yeah.
She's like, oh, that's Kirk Thatcher. Funnier. Yeah, it's the guy.
It's the guy, and he recorded that song like he recorded the first song with his friends. He went with his friends, and they recorded I Still Hate You and wrote new lyrics. Oh, that's so great.
It's great.
Yeah.
And that is not the most exciting thing that happens in the episode, but it is a great little Easter egg.
Biggest peaks of fan service. I'll card out some other fan service that I noticed. So Agnes, when Picard solves something where somebody might have said, good job, Sherlock, she says, good job, Dixon Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And later, in a perplexing scene on a rooftop, a woman is reading a Dixon Hill novel, which I thought was fun. By Tracy Torme, the writer of that episode, The Big Goodbye, but also the canonical author of the Dixon Hill novels, which is a fun thing. Mm-hmm. And then my favorite is Punk on Bus.
Yes.
My second favorite bit of fan service in this episode is that the space agency building that Q is on top of, reading his book and snapping his fingers where nothing happens, perplexing, what is that about, is the Jackson Roy Kirk Plaza. And for those who are not big TOS nerds, canonically, Jackson Roy Kirk's the guy who created Nomad and set him out into the galaxy where he collided with Tan Ru and they became a stupid robot that tries to seek out new life and sterilize it because they combined their directives. But anyway, that canonically, that happened in the early 21st century. So the idea here is that like he already launched Nomad and they named a plaza after him, and that is the Jackson Roy Kirk Plaza. That delighted me just because I thought, all right, Star Trek, I see what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You're ladling in all sorts of references to things that we might know, and that, I don't know, it delighted me. Jackson Roy Kirk, that's so hilariously bizarre and obscure, but they no reference too bizarre for Star Trek Picard
or for Star Trek fans as a matter of course.
And then there is another TOS reference that we will get to that happens at the very end of this episode. But I think we should talk about some stuff that happens before the very end.
What?
If we want to do, you know, linear time and all.
You and your linear time. The show is all about how time is all wibbly-wobbly.
Is it ever. Can we talk about Guinan?
Yes, we can talk about Guinan, who I knew he was going to meet Guinan because it's hard not to know that. A couple of things that I was wondering how they would handle. I wondered if Whoopi Goldberg would be playing Guinan.
De-aged.
De-aged, maybe, or they would just explain, like, she just looks like this now because she can control how she looks or whatever. I don't know. Answer, no. Whoopi Goldberg not playing Guinan. Someone who is not doing a Whoopi Goldberg impersonation, but someone who is kind of in spirit of Whoopi Goldberg playing a young Guinan.
And this is Ito Aguirre, who apparently, I read an interview with her today, grew up watching Star Trek The Next Generation.
Well, that's awesome.
And auditioned for a character that she did not know it was Star Trek, and it was a character not named Guinan talking to a character not named Picard. But then she got on her last audition, and they're like, yeah, it's Star Trek. She's like, what?
And you're Guinan.
And I thought it was good. I think that... this is the argument about using the face replacement voice synthesis Luke Skywalker in The Mandalorian. Sorry, spoilers for The Mandalorian.
Oh, no.
Luke Skywalker's in it briefly.
He is.
Anyway, people said, why don't you just cast somebody as young Luke Skywalker and just do it that way? Well, here that's what they did. We're not going to do some weird kind of young Whoopi Goldberg face replacement thing. We're just going to hire an actress to play young Guinan. And I thought she was good, and I thought that she embodied some of the social commentary that this episode is making, set as it is in a version of our world. Yes. And she kind of doesn't give Picard any leeway for quite a while, although he does, know enough about her and drops that she's an Elorian and all of that she has to listen to him. I liked it.
Yes. And I think that face, those de-aging things and CGI things look great if they are on very sparingly. And Guinan plays a pretty central role in this episode. So I think they made 100% the right choice, because I don't think it would have worked.
Right.
And speaking of not working, when Guinan shows up, my wife got very upset because Guinan did not know who Jean-Luc Picard was. She kept turning to me and saying, why doesn't Guinan know who he is?
I spent the entire time shouting why don't you just say, I met you already in 1890.
Arrow, I met you.
Surely you remember that episode. So apparently they probably should have found a way to work it into this episode, knowing we were all going to lose our minds here. But according to the executive producer of the show, who is well aware of canon, he says, and this is going to blow your minds if you haven't thought of this already, he said, just because they are working in front of this time variance that is coming on the 15th, and that's a fun thing that Agnes does, right, where she picks up the 1915 bottle of wine, and she keeps on doing 15s. And
very cause and effect. Good.
I think maybe. And the Borg Queen did say 15 last week. So yes, of course, it's good. That's a time variance, but the fact that they are already in a timeline where they come from a timeline where the Federation doesn't exist means that Time Zero didn't happen, which means that even though there's a variance in 3 days, this timeline isn't right because of time travel, time travel is so dumb. So just go with it. The idea here is that even though they can correct it by making a change here in this alternate timeline so that it will lead to their timeline, the timeline ripples backward. I'm sure they can sci-fi dialogue this, right? It's a nexus point, blah, blah, blah. But the idea that all other time travel that's ever happened, like Kirk and Spock weren't in Star Trek IV. So the punk on the bus, although he may contain some sort of universal knowledge of his neck hurting when he plays a song on the bus, they didn't have the punk on the bus in Star Trek IV, because there was no Star Trek IV, because this is an alternate timeline where the Federation didn't exist. So Federation people could not come back in time. Now, I have a theory about why they didn't address it in this episode, which is that they're going to address it next episode. But
probably.
It's not much of a theory. I think that maybe they have a reason to hold off on that for now. But anyway, that for people who are saying, why doesn't she remember Time Zero? The answer seems to be that they've decided that Time Zero didn't happen. And so she's never met Picard.
And I imagine the one of the revelations at the end is Q doesn't have his powers, seemingly.
He snaps his fingers and nothing happens.
Which is disturbing to him. And there was kind of like something never quite right with Q, but something seems even stranger with Q in the first episode, right? So he could be going through something, or he could be suffering the effects of not having met Jean-Luc Picard in the future, who has saved him several times. I wonder. I don't know. That's just my.
I like that. I like that. That's really good that they affect each other.
Because they have such a close relationship.
Or it could be related to what happens at the end of this episode, which is another kind of like wild conspiracy theory that I'll save. More of a conspiracy corner.
I probably should have saved my theory for the conspiracy corner, but pretend you didn't hear that, listener.
So
and I'll repeat it later.
Rios. Oh, we should mention the dog. There's a cute dog.
There is a cute dog named Luna.
Mm-hmm. And then her buddy takes the dog away. Apparently that dog actor better than the dog actor plays number one. Although I would like to make this point that in a small ceremony earlier this week, I changed my Paramount Plus viewing profile picture to number one.
Oh.
The dog.
It was open only to family and close friends.
Yes, and the pets. And my pets. But I did that. So yes, there's a dog too. What does Rios do in this episode? He just sits in a cell.
Sits in a cell and then sits on a bus.
Yeah, and then sits on a bus. Although I'm going to say it, maybe my favorite single moment in this entire episode is when Rios explains to the mean ICE officer exactly who he is by completely telling the truth and having the guy roll his eyes. I kind of love that. In fact, I thought to myself, this would have been the trailer to release for this season before it started. You show Los Angeles, you show a cell, a guy gets up. Oh my God, it's Rios. What's going on? And he says, let me tell you who I am. And he tells you, and the guy just turns away. And they're like, Picard season two. And you're like, what? I think it would be great because he tells the story. And it's like, and there's a Borg queen and there's a timeline. And the guy's like, whoa, buddy, I am not your therapist. Walks away.
I love that scene. Apparently, the old guy is a biological robot. Nobody can really explain it to me.
Nobody can explain that to me, right? Oh, it's so good. So I'm going to say it. I a lot of praise for a lot of people in Picard. Justifiably so. Like I said, when we watched the first episode of this season, I had not really recognized how good a job they did at creating this ensemble last season because I was so happy to see them all. And I think that people justifiably praise Allison Pill as Agnes Girardi. I think she's giving a great performance. I think the Borg Queen, whose name I got wrong last time, but turns out is an actress I've seen in a bunch of stuff, but she's unrecognizable as the Borg Queen, Annie Wershing. I think she does a great job. But Rios, I love Rios so much. He's so great. The actor is, you know, they give him funny stuff, but he pulls it off. He's doing the Han Solo-y kind of thing, but as a Starfleet captain, I think it really works for me. I think he's really great. And that scene is perfect where he's like, they don't tell me these things, but there's stuff going on and I'm a captain of a ship and like, that's what's going on. And the guy's like, whatever, dude. I love it. Love Rios.
Yes, he doesn't get to do much in this episode other than get electrocuted and or tasered.
They tase him, bro. They tase him.
They don't tase him, bro, but they do. And have that scene when it's very good. Well, and he has the scene with the doctor and they talk.
Sure, but it's all kind of like, again, his plot line is on hold because he has to ride a bus.
Yes, he's just waiting to be picked up. And I don't understand why they don't transport him. Well, I guess they don't know where he is because he doesn't have his communicator. All right, fine.
They don't know. And then they say the thing about the transporter isn't working when you're not still.
Oh, that's true.
Which is their way of like saying they got to stop the bus so that they
stop the bus.
Transport him off. Yeah, there's a lot of – Girardi has to do a lot of techno babble, but I do like – again, it's kind of replaying stuff from last episode. And there's not a lot of it. But I do really appreciate the – really eerie and creepy and disturbing game of cat and mouse between Agnes and the Borg Queen, especially when Agnes convinces the Borg Queen to do something for her as a favor and then just shuts it all down and walks out when she's done. Like, yeah, I'm not going to give you what I promised. Bye. And she walks out. I'm like, wow.
We're not going
to. You are meaner. You just did a mean thing to the Borg Queen. Wow. Good for you.
I don't know if that's a good decision, but
you're probably going to pay for that later. But it's great. Those scenes are amazing, and I'm very disturbed by them because I'm like, oh no, what terrible things are they going to do to Agnes? But it also didn't. You know, again, it was one of those things where like the scenes in general are good, but in a season that's all story arc, it didn't actually really drive anything forward, it felt like to me. It was really more just there to remind us that Agnes and the Borg Queen are jousting with one another, and we'll get back to that in a future episode.
Yeah, I agree. And Seven and Rafi are just running around stealing police cars, getting in police car chases.
Lots of squealing tires, smashing into stuff.
Rafi has a phaser, even though she told everyone not to take a phaser.
She shoots out a window, and that was not necessary because she could just have opened the door with her, which I thought was funny. Like, I like Seven and Rafi's banter and all that. Mm-hmm. But that was a lot. Again, like I said at the beginning of this episode, it was a lot of car chase. It was a lot of unnecessary. It felt like padding. It felt like they were filling up the episode, which is silly because just make it shorter. It's fine.
That's true.
Nobody's going like, hey, Paramount Plus, I paid for 45 minutes and you only gave me 40.
I demand a refund. And they went to the whole bad driving joke a bit too much during the car chase. But
yeah, well, lady drivers, am I right? Nobody said, but still, somebody pointed out that Tom Paris apparently taught her to drive off camera in the holodeck. Oh, at
that
some
makes
point.
Sense.
And there was a line, so they wanted a line of like, look, I Tom Paris taught me how to drive. This is the best I can do, and that would have been actually really funny.
It would have been
because they would have been throwing Tom Paris under the bus, and everybody likes that. That would have been hilarious.
It's true. But they don't really do much except find out where Rios is, and then get there.
They get beamed there because they don't even take the car there. They stop the car.
It'll be like an hour to get there,
and then are beamed out. Well, yeah, because it is little L.A. landscape for you. Castaic is in the far north part of the San Fernando Valley. It's basically all the way right up against the Grapevine, and that's far from downtown from L.A. So
plus traffic,
just little something. There's traffic. You know, you don't want to go up there. You're going on the 405 or the 5, and it's like it's very bad. L.A. people know what I'm talking about.
They do.
It's get up there to Santa Clarita, Saugus, which is, by the way, it's also a call out to, I think they shoot the show in Saugus or something like that. I think they actually shoot up there in the San Fernando Valley. So it's kind of a tip of the cap to where they shoot Star Trek Picard. But it is far from L.A. So you have to beam them. But they stole a car and had a joyride.
And then got beamed out.
Which brings us to, first off, I like that Picard. I worried that Jean-Luc was going to spend his time on the spaceship set and never venture out into
he's out.
21st century. But he's out there and he talks to Guinan and all of that.
Talking to girls.
Canonical implications are that 10 Forward is actually named nostalgically for her bar on Earth.
I guess that's true.
Interesting.
I guess.
And then at the end, she says, I'm not the Watcher, but I can take you to the Watcher, which is this person who is a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, take me to your manager. It's like the guy, Picard, really, is like a Karen. He's like, take me to your manager.
And I like the fact that Guinan is like, well, you know, they are assigned to certain people to watch out over their destiny. And Picard is like, what do you mean by destiny and this assignment? She's like, well, they're very vague about it, so don't it? So
yeah, I don't really want to know. But they have like the ability to possess people, and their eyes turn all white, and they and then when they're unpossessed, they're like, whatever, and they walk away, which I actually thought was good because, you know, you should be kind of disturbed when you get depossessed by someone.
Yes, and you're looking at an old man in a park and you're
why is, well, surely this nice old man is not involved in this at all. I must have just spaced out for a minute. I'll walk away.
I'll carry
but
on.
In the end we get well, it's not Laris.
It's
Orla Brady who plays Laris. Mm-hmm. Who is one of the, by the way, one of the 10-15 actors to have been in Star Trek and Doctor Who. This is kind of a fun little tidbit. Most of them don't count because most of them are Torchwood, Children of Earth, which was shot in L.A. And so, of course, those are California actors. But there's an IMDb page that actually has like a list of all the people who've been in both Star Trek and Doctor Who. But Orla Brady, who plays Laris, was in a modern Doctor Who episode, and I had forgotten that. I was like, oh yeah, that is her. But here she doesn't have Romulan ears on.
Nope. She has some kind of weird smoky door that she opens and closes.
Yeah. So portentous statements and a rectangular smoky door that makes them disappear. And if people are wondering what the heck this is, I will tell you now, and this is a little conspiratorial, so you can skip this part if you want
let's
to.
Fire off the conspiracy phaser.
All right. Thank you.
You're
more of a photon torpedo, but that's okay. That's what you got to take what you can get. It is so. Who has been referred to as a supervisor before, and who transports from place to place using a vaporous rectangle? The answer is Gary Seven.
Oh,
from the original series where Gene Roddenberry was trying to do another TV show starring Robert Lansing and Terry Garr, which frankly would have been awesome because it would have had Robert Lansing and Terry Garr on it, but it didn't take Assignment Earth. And that is a bit of canon that has never been touched in filmed Star Trek. A lot of adaptations have talked about it. The comic book series, the Star Trek Year 5 recent comic book series, which is very good if you're a fan of TOS, I recommend it, has a whole Gary Seven thing in it. There's a lot of Gary Seven in there because comic books can still cast Robert Lansing, who passed away quite a while ago. But in the comics, he's still alive. It's great. But anyway, I think maybe they're touching that bit of canon for the first time here, where the because if you think about it, Robert Lansing was like a human kidnapped thousands of years ago by mysterious aliens and trained and like to make sure that things go the way they're supposed to on Earth, and he has his little mission, his little cat friend, and if you haven't seen that episode, that just sounded crazy, but I assure you that's what Assignment Earth is. Yes, he's got a cat.
I can verify.
And he has a magic pen, and he has a computer, and he has swinging pad, and it is an amazing episode. I love that episode. Anyway, I think this is where they're going here. I think that there is a mysterious group of people who perhaps are aware of the time variance. I don't know. Who are part of that same mysterious, shadowy organization as Gary Seven was. Keep in mind, Assignment Earth was set in the late 60s, so late 60s to 2025. Not unreasonable that they would still be active in this time on Earth.
It's true.
And that, why is it Laris? I think maybe it's really just like they chose a person who was appealing to Picard.
Oh, right? So it's not actually her, but it
yeah,
is,
that's yeah, my guess. Because otherwise, it doesn't really follow otherwise. So that's my theory.
Laris, now they're going to remaster all of the TNG episodes and just insert Laris in the background.
Oh, gasp. Anyway, I would love them to do a riff on Gary Seven, because that was such an interesting part of what was not intended to be Star Trek canon. It was intended to be canon for it was a backdoor pilot for a show that didn't get made, but it is part of Star Trek canon. The idea that there were mysterious human agents of aliens who were on Earth to guide Earth to the right destiny, basically, which is what they say here. That's interesting. I don't know if that's where they're going. I'm in for the ride for that, because that is just like we were talking last week. Again, mildest of spoilers, but like we were talking about how Captain Kirk's pre-Enterprise life has not been really touched by official Star Trek canon. Same is true for Gary Seven. So interesting if they're going there.
It's true. And that's really all that happens in this episode. We already talked about the Q thing.
Snaps his fingers. It's the Europa Project. Maybe this is related. So remember, in Star Trek, they talk about lots of space stuff happening way sooner than it does in our world. So here they've got the Europa Project, where they're sending astronauts to Europa, and there's a whole building, and it's like got the signs on it, and it seems like this is like NASA or whatever is working on this project, and that they're going to launch it. And Q was reading in the LA Times, and it says, like, is this the year we're going to send people to Europa? And
he's whispering to this woman.
Yeah. Who's reading the Dixon Hill novel, and then he snaps his fingers and nothing happens. And he goes, nothing. Ooh, that's not good.
No. And then the episode ends. And you say, what? On multiple levels. What?
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's good. It just feels like the story advanced, like I said earlier, the story advanced by a smaller fraction than it did the first three episodes. Mm-hmm. But I'm still feeling good about the season, and I still am. I mean, I watched the whole episode just smiling.
Yes, as did I.
It's just at the end, I was like, oh, okay, I guess we can end here.
That's right, but I don't want the game to end.
No. Reference acknowledged.
Thank you. Speaking of...
Guinan's license plate is S2E1. Which is season 2, episode 1, which refers to Guinan appearing in Star Trek Picard season 2, episode 1, and premiering TNG season 2, episode 1.
Well spotted, Jason.
I didn't spot it. I'm going to give all credit to TrekMovie.com. That's where that came
well
from.
Well spotted, TrekMovie.com.
TrekMovie.com, it's a good site. They do a good recap. And SO2E01 is the car that Guinan drives. Love it.
So that is.
I also like the idea that there's like an alien who has a bar and she has Saurian brandy. Does she tell people where the Saurian brandy comes from? These Earth people who have never had first contact before? Or is that only for the aliens? When the aliens come into the bar and they give the little symbol, they do a like live long and prosper or something. And she's like, oh, I see. You're one of those. And it's like, well, then I've got stuff. Here's the Romulan ale and the Saurian brandy for you. But everybody else just gets Budweiser. That's how that works.
It's a drop off there.
Yeah, and Slusho.
Well, she just leaves it on the counter. Bar. It's like,
an alien receptacle for booze is sitting on the bar.
Mm-hmm. Not great, Guinan.
Maybe that's her tell. Maybe that's how she finds out the people who are time travelers and or aliens. They know what the Saurian brandy container is.
And she wants to listen to their stories. So she wants to give a little hint. And someone will say, hey, I see this bottle. And then
she's from a race of listeners. Although I do like how they acknowledge the thing that was established in yesterday's Enterprise, right? Which is that that either all Elorians or at the very least Guinan is sensitive to changes in the timeline, and that's that's a good thing, because here we are. And that's why I think when Picard says, my name is Jean-Luc Picard, she reacts that way, is that she's got some sort of sense of like, oh, okay, something very strange is going on here.
Yes.
I need to deal with this.
Yes. Speaking of time travel, this is not a good segue, but there's more Star Trek news.
Oh, more Star Trek news.
Yes, we should briefly touch upon, just because we cover Star Trek on this podcast. Don't know if you're aware of that, Jason.
Is the punk on bus getting his own Paramount Plus series?
I would not be surprised. But speaking of Paramount Plus, something is coming to Paramount Plus. April 5th, they are releasing Star Trek The Motion Picture, The Director's Cut, in 4K. Remastered, all gussied up with some new special effects, and based on the trailer,
looks good.
It looks really good. I saw Star Trek The Motion Picture in the theater, not when it first came out, because I think it was like a year old, but a couple of years ago when
I was eight. And I did see it in the theater. And as I said on Slack earlier, I have very few memories of it, which, given that I was a rabid Star Trek fan at the time, doesn't speak well for Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Not a super memorable movie. But I saw it several years ago when they were doing the Philadelphia film folks were doing a Star Trek thing where every night they had they had a showing of each Star Trek movie. In the theater. So I went to see Star Trek The Motion Picture because I was busy for many of the other ones that I actually wanted to see, but I wanted to see one of them. And my point is the print that they had, they like found somewhere, and it was, they told people ahead of time, they're like, this print is not very good. About a third of it is very pink.
Interesting.
And so I went in knowing that it wasn't going to be a very good print. And it's amazing to see what they can do when they have, one assumes, the original print and then a bunch of master wizards doing things that I don't understand to make it better.
I bought the TMP Director's Edition DVD. And that problem with that, of course, is that was done at standard def resolutions, and now we're living in a 4K world. And what I liked about it is so it's not shorter, but it is, and Robert Wise did supervise it. It's not shorter, but it is more of like people and less of endless effect shots. There's still, look, people, if you come to TMP for the endless effect shots, and why wouldn't you? Because that's what it is. They're still there, but they're more judiciously trimmed. I'm going to recommend there are some fan edits of TMP that try to turn it into more of an actual like storyline and less of people looking at special effects that are pretty good. But but what was nice about it is that they added a bunch of stuff in, new special effects to improve some of the things, the best of which is the stuff on Vulcan, where Vulcan stuff looks way better with like big
statues
and stuff. And like Vulcan looks less like a backlot and more like Vulcan is. And in fact, I think that director's edition influenced Enterprise and has influenced the modern Star Trek in terms of like what Vulcan actually looks like, because they sort of have built to that thing. It looks great. And the director's edition is, I think, way better. It's better than the regular edition. So,
I agree.
And if you are watching Picard, especially in the US, you're watching it, and you will probably also get this, because if you're watching it in the US, you're watching it on Paramount Plus. And yes. And that's how they're debuting it. It will be a Blu-ray, and there will be Fathom event screenings and all of that. But you can also just watch it on your TV, and it looks like it will look good. And I will watch it again. I'm up for that.
I'm going to watch it again. I love the opening of the motion picture.
It's so good, right, with the Klingons and everything. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it.
And the Klingon music, the score with
the music is so good, man, in this book. Look, we could make a list of all the things that are good in Star Trek motion picture. And that's why I mentioned the fan edits, because mm-hmm. if you take out, like, there's a moment in the motion picture where Sulu is looking at we see Sulu staring at nothing that we can see for a long time. And then we see what he's looking at for like five times as long. And then I think we cut back to Sulu again. And then we cut back to the thing. And it's like, what are you doing? Tighten this up. Tighten it up.
It's a lot of people looking at things. And yeah. So then you become...
It's got its issues.
A person looking at people looking at things.
Yeah. I mean, we're not here to litigate Star Trek the Motion Picture. No. But Star Trek 2 is like, Gene Roddenberry's not involved, let's make a movie, and it's brilliant. Star Trek Motion Picture is like, well, Star Wars is very popular, and we're going to take your TV show, and we're going to just turn it into a movie, and you're going to recycle a plot from an original series episode, Jackson Roy Kirk, inventor of Nomad, by the way, mm-hmm. We're going to give you lots of money.
Lots of money, yes.
But you're going to spend it on like 2001-esque kind of very long special effects sequences. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a fascinating and frustrating movie because we're seeing our friends who we haven't seen since the mm-hmm. original series went off the air. And although I wasn't alive then, I was alive during the 70s and became a Star Trek fan during that period where it was on in reruns. And so the idea that there was going to be a movie that's the Star Wars people got their movie, but now we were going to get our movie. Like, it was so exciting. And then the movie's like, fortunately they made more Star Trek movies because then mm-hmm. they made a bunch of really great movies after that. But
yes,
motion picture is what it is. It is
what it is.
It's okay.
It's the one with the pastel uniform.
Yeah, the pajamas. And yeah. Aaliyah is kind of interesting, but they kill her. And
they do. Spoilers for the motion picture.
Or do they? Because they make her into like a robot replica, right? Mm-hmm. She's kind of a golem-esque figure.
Eaten by V'ger, I guess. And
then V'ger makes a simulation of her in a robot body that is perfect. So, and you're like, but she's a robot. But then they like
Decker in a classic, dives in.
In a classic Kirk moment, he tautologically confuses her robot programming and turns her back into regular old Aaliyah. That's a good character beat in that movie.
It's true.
Anyway, yeah, thank you for bringing that up because the trailer looks great, and I'm sure a lot of people will watch it. And, you know, it is what it is, but the director's version is better. I wish I had the name of the fan edit that I found that is really quite good. Let me see if I can find it here. Not that I would download a fan edit from the internet.
And I think that if you haven't watched the Star Trek the Motion Picture commercials that they had where people were reacting to having seen Star Trek the Motion Picture, you have to watch those because you watch it and you think these are the best people's reactions that they included in the commercial.
So if you search for Star Trek Reunion fan edit, you will find information about the 1 hour and 43 minute long fan edit of Star Trek the Motion Picture that is paced a little bit more like Star Trek the original series and a little less like 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Because that's a two hour 15 minute movie.
Yeah, and so when I saw this 4K thing, I thought, well, you know what this is going to really do is the fan edits are going to be way better because there's going to be this 4K version out there, which is fine. I have another fan edit that's actually pretty cool that I'll mention, not Star Trek related. Is somebody did a fan edit of The Martian, where you never see anybody but Matt Damon, when he at the very beginning you see people. And then he gets stranded. Spoilers for The Martian. He gets stranded on Mars. And then at the very end, spoilers for The Martian, he gets off of Mars. But in the movie as released, you cut back and forth between him on Mars and people on Earth trying to save him. And in this fan edit called Mark Watney of Mars, you never cut back to Earth.
Oh.
And it's really interesting. Like, I know why the actual movie shouldn't be that way, and the book is not like that and all. It's kind of really interesting in that it really puts you in, you know, Roger Ebert famously said that movies are a machine that generates empathy. And in some ways, I think that Mark Watney fan edit is really good at generating empathy for his situation, because we're stranded with him. Mm-hmm. Instead of getting to see the people back on Earth working on the solution. So fan edits are fun, is what I'm saying. And Star Trek Reunion is a fun fan edit. And yay, a 4K HDR version of the motion picture that fans can then re-edit to reduce that scene where Sulu is looking at a thing that we don't see for a very long time. Because, wow, you'll know it when you see it, if you watch it. If you don't know it already, like, there is a scene where you're like,
seeing it.
I am just watching Sulu watch something I can't see for a long time.
And he kind of smiles a little bit. You're like, what
do
you do?
What's going on? Oh, my. That is amazing.
Oh, yes. Just the – and I have very deep memories of that little shuttlecraft just slowly flying by the Enterprise.
Yeah. Well, and if you say to yourself, this seems awfully a lot like Star Trek 2, the answer is Star Trek 2's budget was so small that they just reused a bunch of that stuff. The reason that there's a shuttle flyby of the Enterprise in Star Trek 2 is because there was footage of a shuttle flyby of the Enterprise in Star Trek The Motion Picture, and they reused it. That's the only reason it happens. Oh, I love it.
What a savings. Hilarious.
Anyway, Gary 7, just mark it down. We'll see. Check back here next week.
Yes, check back to see. We'll check in on Jason's predictions. We'll see. He's so far 0-1.
Yeah, I'm 0-1 this whole season. Yes, you know, it's trekmovie.com, and I don't know if they knew something, but they put Laris as one of the options for. Ooh. Before we go, I wanted to say, I know that there are like contracts with actors, but like when you put Laris in the previously on, and you put Orla Brady in the opening credits, kind of ruins your reveal at the end, right? Just a little bit.
See, this is
if you're paying attention.
The problem with paying attention, Jason. I did not pay attention.
Skip intro.
I did skip the intro. Oddly enough, though, I am not spoiler averse, and so there was a discussion in the Incomparable Slack about this episode, which I read, in which it was mentioned that Laris is in this episode, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. I don't really know what she's doing, but that'll be interesting. And I completely forgot that when I started watching this. So then she shows up, and I was like, oh, it's Laris.
Well, by the time I got to the end, I had kind of forgotten that Orla Brady was credited, but then when she appeared, I was like, well, she was credited. it didn't matter to me. I know some people it matters more. But like, if you're really expecting it to end the episode on this shocking reveal, mm-hmm. having her be in the – this is the problem with the previously on is the previously on is literally – because that happens in shows now where I see the previously on and I'm like, I can tell you what's going to happen in this episode now because of what you've shown me from previous episodes.
Well, I want to make sure that you know.
It's very important. It's a streaming show. You can just go back and watch – previous, I don't know. Anyway,
I just assume that they think we're very dumb, and so they have to tell us.
It's not a terrible bet.
It's true.